Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schandelberg. You know, Kirk, I don't know that we've talked about it in a while, but you've had a habit of breaking things. Like blenders and or things, I shouldn't say breaking things.
My wife has participated, yes.
Okay.
Yes, we have had failures of kitchen appliances, mainly it seems.
Yeah. What I'm thinking of is that when you do have a failure, you're the one that takes it apart or wants to see it taken apart or is interested in the failure analysis part of it. That's
right.
What I was getting at, yeah.
Right.
Now, I know, and I know you've worked with companies where even laptops, right? It fails and the customer complains or goes back to the store and then we don't get it back. We can't do failure analysis if we don't get it back.
You know, right. That's a big issue in the progression of reliability engineering.
My
main issues is how can you know how to make it more reliable if you don't know what makes it unreliable.
Yep.
And that's real fundamental to this whole field. And I find that very lacking. Not necessarily the engineering or reliability engineer's fault that he can't get to that information, but it's a lot of times because of the chain of the supply chain, it's very difficult to deal with, especially in these large companies like Hewlett-Packard or Dell or Lenovo or something like that, making millions of these computers. They have these supply chains, and they have multiple supply chains for the same component, the same power supply, because they're doing such high volumes.
Mm-hmm.
They can't really depend on one. So tracing these things back, and it usually goes back to products split apart. So it's very difficult for these companies to justify doing detailed work and on a $5 power supply when you get $10,000 a month back.
That's right.
It's just can't get through it.
Well, you can't do it on every one of them in a case like that. But what you've seen it too is where they just say, well, don't even send it back, or we're not going to do failure analysis.
We're just going to
look at what the customer complaint said it was, or our first cursory look at it and create a Pareto. Sometimes, especially for consumer products that are, seasonal type stuff, they come out every six months or every year. By the time you do the failure analysis, if the products get to the field and you get one back, you're already on the next design. You're already locking in the next design.
Exactly. Yeah. You have a design and production cycle that's so short that you really don't have, a lot of time between the product being released and then getting to the field, having the problem and getting a corrective action. By that time, you've come out with a new design that may or may not have that same. Hopefully, at least you've addressed that in the new design if you have any idea what caused it. And that's another reason to stimulate it to find what caused it. If you have that problem and you don't know what it is, then you better get a few back from the field and stimulate them until you can get them to reproduce the problem. And that's, of course, with my recommendations, always voltage, temperature, vibration, all the environmental stresses to try and to get that, because the biggest problem is the intermittence. Problems that that are reset when the product's power cycled or something like that. So getting consistently finding these things, because if they come back dead, then it's pretty straightforward to find out with a probe and go through the circuit and see where the voltages end or where the signal ends or what's not working on the product. Those are the easy ones.
Yeah.
The products, and of course, you and I know that in many companies, the percentage of products that come back and are declared cannot duplicate or look apparently good and working to the company that they're returned to is up to maybe 60 to 70% sometimes. I've seen that much where they really don't know. And, you know, it could be the environmental conditions of the end use, you know, in India or someplace that's not air conditioned or.
And we've talked about these issues before. And we're one of my thoughts, though, is that it's amazing that in our normal everyday operation, it really depends on the company and its culture as to how aggressive they are at, you know, taking field data back and sorting it out and fixing and stuff. And some are way better at it than others. And there's lots of forces at play. Now, what here's where it really changes, though, in my mind, right, is remember when the Galaxy Fold came out months ago?
Had a nice podcast on that.
Right. Yeah. We talked about always, this, the basic issue.
Like they're giving us content, you know.
But, you know, they have a reviewer, like the Wall Street Journal tech reviewer, going, hey, it broke. And they show it on camera, right, on a national, an international newspaper, essentially.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they only ship 100 of these things to reviewers.
Yeah. Right.
And so not only did it stop production, right, and cause a redesign, but it also, so you know there was some failure analysis there. You know it was, they made time to solve that one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if you or I would have gotten it, we would have taken it back to the store and said, well, it's your fault.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But it takes on a different veil or a different urgency when it's on Yelp or it's on a national, you know, comment board or it's on national news, you know, or key reviewers or whatever. But I mean, is that fair? Is that, I mean, shouldn't an organization look at a failure from just anybody's source and treat it like it was a national reviewer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
I knew we'd agree on this. I knew it.
I mean, the first one they could get their hands on or whatever. But Fred, you know, this is always where I'm thinking, why did they let that get out? Why didn't they test that better?
But they tested it carefully. You know that. Yeah, they tested it very carefully.
And in the case of the folding phone, they actually showed videos of them testing.
Yeah.
Which obviously showed, you know, to me and others in the field of testing that they missed quite a few things about that. You know, obviously the first thing they do, and they have, and I don't know that. It's good. I just looked up what's happened to the folding phone. I don't think they've gotten one out there yet. Again,
no, I think a few people.
Seen, you know, that was a pretty big publicity hit. You know, because obviously they thought they had a reliable. Obviously, they thought that they had a reliable phone.
You know, I don't agree with that. I don't know that they knew they had a reliable phone. I think they wanted to believe they had a reliable phone, which is different. I bet you there's folks in the company they were looking at this and it's not working, right? But but they had rushed to be the market, had all yada yada yada, right? Get it out. Right. You've been there.
Sure. You know, well, this is acceptable to ship. A lot of times you hear this is acceptable to ship.
Yep.
And you go, well, you know, this is a leading indicator, or it could be an indicator of a much worse problem once you have 1,000 out there.
That's right.
And they said, well, we've got to get it out there because our competitor's about to, we know that they're about to introduce a similar product. And so, you know, again, they try and, as they say, they want to believe it. Even Galaxy made, or Samsung made a video of this folding machine showing the phone folding thousands of times in a very, very controlled, consistent pressure and consistent forces, which is not the real world. And so, you know, it's that trying to push out that product real quick like that was a disaster. Now it's, you know, now I think the market's going to be very, very cautious. And it's not going to be, early adopters may not run to the next folding phone to come out.
Mm-mm. You're going to wait for, you know, let a few paid reviewers take a look at it and a few other people give it a try before they chunk out 2,000 bucks for it.
Right. And that cost is not even considered, you know, how that damages the future of a technology or a possibly promising technology. I don't think it will be done probably at some point.
Oh, yeah.
But it's pushed back certainly the public's concern and acceptance of probably of this kind of thing.
Well, the same with Tesla and their autonomous feature on their vehicle, you know, and got in an accident. One that I'm thinking of was in Florida where
the guy let it run
and it drove him into a semi truck that was hard to see for the equipment.
And this is kind of it's kind of a thing where, you know, the customer was not supposed to use it that way. Well, but see, you put in everything almost to that level. This is where I worry about autonomous vehicles and we still have, I mean, either it's kind of going to have to be binary, either humans involved or not.
Mm-hmm. You can't go both ways.
No, there's not like he's got to pay, you know, 20% attention to what's going on in the highway. He can't. No, you've either got to be 100% or completely disconnected, because I believe that a lot of human reactions would be based on the belief that the car's reactions are kind of a computer can react much faster than a human, but humans are going to react stopping the car and controlling the car based on their own human abilities to react. So anyway, but it's an issue with expecting the customer to use the device in a way and be very aware of the warnings. In other words, do not expect the car to drive itself.
Yeah. Well, it was like you said, though, is what made me think of the Tesla one is that, like with the Galaxy, it set it back. And when we have a battery fire in a product, it sets it back. I don't think there's hoverboards around anymore. There's probably a few around, but, you know, there.
I see the single wheel thing.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
That's it looks cool. But there's all kinds of stuff that, you know, we're pushing the edge of technology all the time.
Yes.
And some just work and some don't. And some are reliable or not. I think it crosses the threshold, though, that if it's a spectacular failure, right, or newsworthy failure.
Certainly, like the Dell laptop blowing up the first time a battery fire happened. Right.
And then somebody put it on YouTube, you know?
And
if it wasn't on YouTube, it would have been 20 people would have knew about it, and that would it, right? It would have impacted a local group. But once it went on YouTube and got 1 million downloads, game over, right? So
Even though it was one out of, you know, 10 million probably units or something, you know, it was a very low occurrence relatively. It was so dramatic an occurrence when it happened, and everybody, you know, understands the danger of fire. It had much more of an impact than the actual risk of what.
Well, that's the hard part, right? Tell that to the guy that it, you know, sitting on his lap. It's I don't care what the risk is. Mine caught on fire. Yeah, the airline said, no, you
didn't want to. Yeah,
don't bring them on air anymore. We're not going to take that risk. Those things are so hard to guard against in a reliability program, right? But if it turned out, and I'm going way back to the, what was that car with the rear gas tank?
Was it a Vega?
Corvair?
No, Vega. A Ford.
Yeah, it was a Ford.
Something like that,
right.
Yeah, but and I think it had a place where the gas tank, was placed, was an issue.
It was exposed in a rear-end collision. It would rupture and oftentimes then caught on fire. But even after a number of those accidents occurred, and this was in the 60s, right? And it's kind of what made Ralph Nader as powerful
well,
as it was.
That was a Corvette.
Corvette.
That was unsafe at any speed.
Yeah. And so, but it went into a national documentary and a big mm-hmm. campaign and all that stuff. Today, right. one guy with a YouTube, you know, puts it up on YouTube. And so the price to publicize failures has changed dramatically.
Oh, absolutely. The our media, internet has made the speed of communication, mass communication, almost instant.
Yeah.
As soon as somebody finds something interesting, they'll publish it to everybody.
It goes back to the when we're in halt or we're doing testing and we find something that fails,
right?
Unless it smoked or caused a fire or right. like a Dilbert cartoon sent shards into the ceiling or something like that.
Right.
Unless it actually fails that way or has a really good chance of failing that way, it's really hard to convince people to fix it, right? In some cultures, in some places, in organizations. Right. Others take every issue and sort it out. It's just that I think my main point here, Kirk, is that it is very difficult, and I don't have the answer for it. Is when you're creating a reliability plan or you're going in to do your testing and evaluations and setting up your program to say, we want to not be on TV with how bad our product is.
Right.
And how do you actually do that?
How do you actually do that?
Yeah.
You go, again, Fred, you use every stress you can imagine and certainly in a handheld device or a car, a vehicle, you're going to get all kinds of stresses from the environmental conditions, mm-hmm. from moisture, water intrusion, certainly extremes of temperature. I don't see that. They don't do that. Again,
people
are not taking products to limits, to fundamental material limits or functional limits, and that's what they need to do. But they always learn this after the fact. And then you could take that phone back and you could show them how how you could reproduce it under stress once you know about it from the field, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. nobody does that. You've already found out the problem. So, you know, mm-hmm. again, it's the problem, and I've written about this where, once it becomes a problem in the field, it's already identified. And so going back to the lab and showing, you know, it takes an extra effort for the guy like myself who understands that most of the failure mechanisms can be stimulated to be accelerated through an environmental condition specific to that, you know, device, that
mechanism. Yeah.
Right. You don't know that before, you know, you've got it out in the field. That's one of the difficulties. Once you have it in the field, then you can show, you know, I could precipitate this through rapid thermal cycling or long-term exposure at high temperature or something like that.
Once you know what you're looking for, it's easy.
Exactly. But then to go back and tell the guys, okay, we've learned, we had this disaster. Let's, you know, cover this, you know, do this again where we can expose this. Well, they go back and they do this specific stress for that past problem.
Right. Yeah, I saw that. I've seen that.
Don't do anything else.
Yeah. We're only trying to avoid the ones we've already fixed.
You know, they go look for the hole in the wall that they've already found everything, you know. But another one's just right next to it, or another, you know, mechanism or something that they just, you know, because they didn't
I've told you that story. This guy was all bent on working on a problem with the ASICs for this one design he was working on. And the memory chips that were needed to operate the ASICs and to do the mm-hmm. testing and so on, they kept failing. So his test kept getting aborted as he's fixing memory chips, replacing chips. And he says, well, isn't that a problem in the field too? And he goes, oh yeah, it's a big problem in the field, but I'm not working on that problem.
Yeah, that's another department.
That's the vendor's problem. We're not dealing with that one. So if you fix this one, you still got, then the memory is going to fail, right? It's
right.
Like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Now, there's so many pieces to this, though. Is the hard part, I think, is convincing an organization. It's the same as just saying you want a good, reliable product, and you need to take care of these intermittent issues and these small issues you find as you're going along. I find that it's a hard sale saying, oh, we need to do this so we don't end up on the nightly news. It's rare. It really, really is rare. Or do a recall. Those are rare. The trouble is, and I've run into many organizations, though, that if you take a product and it caught fire in your chamber while you're just setting it up, they fix that. Most people get it, right?
Right.
They will go fix that. But I think your point, though, Kirk, to summarize, is that you have to put the stresses on it. You have to test it a dozen different ways or 100 different ways to find where those issues.
And you have to do more than one sample. You have to get a few samples.
Yeah.
You have to risk that.
Yeah.
Now, especially in mass production, when you're talking about high volume products, you know you're not going to have time to go. You're not going to get a quick report back from the field, probably.
No, it's going to be 2-3 months to shipping. Yeah.
Like where you're making something 1,000 products and you have a very limited number of customers, that you might be able to send out a beta version to your customers and they do some initial testing. That usually what happened.
Yeah.
But when you're doing a consumer product, you're usually making thousands of them ready to when you announce the availability, you're going to have thousand or more already built up in the warehouse.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, you know, really that's where the cost and benefit of testing to extremes on, you know, I'd say 100 units, I think, at least. And I'm sure these phone companies use at least 100 to 200 or 300 units of phones to test with, that they take everything out of them. They test them to, I mean, if they leave any of them working, they've left money on the table.
Yeah,
you know?
It varies. I know that when I was working with HP on inkjet printers, and some of the lines were making 1 million printers a month.
Wow.
And shipping them. And they would test the last rounds of protos that were, you know, on the actual manufacturing lines and kind of manufacturing ready. But we also had time to do amazing amounts of testing. We would get 400 units, 500 units sometimes.
That's a dream.
Yeah. No, they had whole wings of buildings set up just to run these tests. It was amazing.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, a lot of them, they don't utilize the, you know, after they've done, you know, there's groups like do software testing. There's groups that don't really put a lot of stress on the product and don't significantly cause fatigue damage or anything like that. So, you know, those are where I think there's a lot of missed opportunity to take a lot of the designs that have been after they've been used by different test departments that are not hauled, are not test to limits. That they take those and do long-term, you know, long-term stressing with them or something, because just putting them in a, you know, they usually don't ship them or they'll scrap them.
Yeah.
That's kind of a waste. So
Now some of the early, I know the printers, they would either give away or sell them at cost, essentially, or low cost to employees. There was all kinds of things. You never wanted one of those because you never knew which firmware was on it.
Well, I did get a free backpack because they would, Dell would get these backpacks and carriers and cases and, you know, for carrying laptops.
Oh, okay. That'd
be cool. Shock and Vibe department would test them, but then they wouldn't send them back, you know, or anything. And so I remember getting one of those. But it's definitely hard to convince everybody of a future potential loss that you don't know of or a risk.
Right.
But you can always see after the fact and after that loss, like the folding phone or something like that, you could make the calculations. It costs them millions of dollars, if not, you know, tens of millions. So
it's funny how organizations get it after the fact. And the responses can go from denying it, blaming people to, oh, we got to deal with this and recall or whatever. But it's preventing those issues. I agree with you. It's tough, and it takes time to build that case.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you get a lot of movement of people, and that's another problem is, you know, people resign, they don't, or leave, or mm-hmm. especially in technology, there is a lot of mobility.
Yep.
And unfortunately, I hear the, you know, Boeing's head of commercial airplanes had to resign, or did resign just mm-hmm. recently this week because of the Boeing 737 MAX reliability issues, really.
Yeah, it's probably a subject. Sad. Once we learn more about that, we got to
talk about it, right? Yeah. And we'll get, and that'll be one that we will get a full, hopefully we get a open disclosure since it is a public, because it's, you know, again, we don't get very much reliability information about anything in the real world because it's so sensitive.
Yeah.
But in public transportation, it usually is disclosed and talked about. And unfortunately, we're finding out more problems than we really want to.
Yeah, no, that one's just exploding. That one's just getting scary. It is. Yeah, I'm glad I'm not traveling anymore.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of alternative airplanes to fly on.
No. So anyway, let's wrap this one up. We're starting to drift off into other topics and stuff.
Yes.
But the basic idea is if you've got in your organization, if you're listening to this in your organization and you know that there's either unknowns or there's a issue that really could cause a serious problem, it's one of those where it depends on your situation. Do you stand up and make a ruckus to let people know about it? And I would not recommend taking a video of it and putting it on YouTube in the public forum. It's probably a career limiting activity.
I would recommend going into the lab by yourself or in the background and seeing if you can do that, you know, reproduce the problem or stimulate
the problem. Yeah. Show people issue.
You don't, and don't expose it to anybody. Don't let anybody know. But once you're sure you can do this, then you can call in the executives or the head of engineering and say, look, you remember this problem that we couldn't identify? Here it is. I'll reproduce it for you. Or I'll show you how I made it happen on all these units here. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things, if you can do that and background before you, you know, take this, we can possibly show this, you know, that's a risk you're taking. In other words, prove it to yourself first, and then open up the company to show them what the power is.
But if you're listening to this and you've got a good way of doing this, right, or a good solution for this, or you got a particular question that this discussion brought up for you, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and both Kirk and I are available through LinkedIn and through email, and we'd love to hear from you. It really makes our day when we get a follow-up or a good question or something like that. And plus feeds us into our future episodes. So
yes. And thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. And we really hope you got something out of it or enjoyed it.
Thanks, Kirk.
Either way. Okay, yeah. Fred.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.